Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-5380, Brian Hunter, Appellant versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. For the appellant, Mr. Kim. For intervener, CFTC, Mr. Berry, and for the appellee, Mr. Solomon.
Good morning.
May I proceed, Your Honor?
Yes. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Kim from Cobry & Kim. I represent the appellant Brian Hunter, as I did in the proceedings below. This case presents two issues of great personal importance to Mr. Hunter, but also of great public importance. Number one, whether the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has jurisdictional power over natural gas futures, which it is undisputed were trading on a CFTC-regulated exchange. And number two, whether the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has the statutory power to initiate administrative proceedings to levy monetary penalties against human beings, against individuals, as opposed to natural gas companies.
Isn't there a third issue for us today, namely whether we have jurisdiction to hear this case?
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe that in terms of Mr. Hunter's appeal, obviously the way that we are here now is on an appeal from the district court,
right,
where we moved for two forms of relief, a declaratory judgment as to the principle of FERC jurisdiction, and secondly, an injunction to stop the FERC from proceeding with its order to show cause. And I believe these two issues are separable, and I believe with respect to the first issue, which is the matter of FERC jurisdiction, this court's precedent does confer upon the district court jurisdiction in the following manner. First, no matter what one thinks about Section 19B of the Natural Gas Act, this court has pronounced that where there is an explicit statutory rule, statutory prohibition that is being violated, the court has the inherent authority to enforce it.
What case is that?
Your Honor, there's a whole line of ultra-virus cases, but the principle is recently articulated in Aid Association for Lutherans.
But in that case, there wasn't exclusive jurisdiction in the Court of Appeals as there is here.
Your Honor, the...
Isn't that right?
I don't believe that's correct, Judge. I believe that basically in Aid Association for Lutherans, the issue at hand, at least the opinion remarks that it does not matter. It actually does not matter whether there actually is a Section 19B type problem as the FERC wishes to interpret it. I believe the issue Your Honor is getting at is if indeed one says...
There wasn't anything comparable to 19B in that case.
Your Honor, I believe in that case the challenge to the U.S. Postal Service regulations did not allow for a district court challenge. And I believe that in that case...
No, that's not my point. My point is that there was nothing comparable to 19D, which vested exclusive jurisdiction in the D.C. Circuit.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's why we held that the district court had inherent authority to consider an ultra-virus challenge, because otherwise there would have been no basis, no place to challenge it.
Yes, Your Honor. But even in cases where there was a analog to 19B, such as in free enterprise and national mining, the court has held the same, and the way that I believe they can be reconciled is that when the court is exercising ultra-virus jurisdiction, it is not saying, despite the presence of a 19B, which...
Well, wouldn't that... Your theory would completely eviscerate this court's exclusive appellate jurisdiction, because anybody could argue that... file a case in the district court and argue that the agency is violating its statute. In fact, most of our cases are statutory.
Your Honor, they would have to argue so only by reference to an explicit statutory provision. I believe that's the point.
That's what all our cases are. Everybody comes here and argues one way or another that the agency is violating the statute.
And that's why I believe the ultra-virus cases involve a judgment by the court that the statutory prescription at issue is sufficiently explicit, which in this case, the CFTC's exclusive jurisdiction and the entity issue, I believe, rises to that level.
But the Free case and some of the other cases that you cite either are, as Judge Tatel has suggested, that there was no other opportunity for challenge, or it involved a constitutional challenge to the statute. And you're not making a constitutional challenge.
That's correct, Judge. I'm making neither, and I believe that even though the fact patterns in those cases involved that, and that was a factor that the court considered in determining whether it was appropriate for the court to exercise jurisdiction, because to be sure, ultra vires jurisdiction, or ultra vires the doctrine, does not mandate a court to take jurisdiction. It simply gives the power to the courts to do so, where the court isn't saying, we're judges, we're just going to override a statutory provision. And by definition, in those cases, the court is saying, by reference to an explicit statutory provision that is so clear that it is being violated, for example, the exclusive jurisdiction of the entity issues in this case, we have the power to step in now at our discretion and make a ruling. And I believe in the cases that Your Honor is referencing, it was not a prerequisite that it be a constitutional challenge or that it could not be raised later. I believe in the court's opinions in this area, there is both a tendency to obviously look at the 19B analogs, the exact language in each case to determine how clear and convincing it was that Congress wanted to subsume the type of challenge at issue into that clause, first of all. That's why in some cases, obviously, the court decides to step in, and in some cases, it does not. And then where the court determines either that despite the presence of a 19B that clearly encompasses the issue, that another statute, another statutory provision is so clear that—
I know, but I guess what I don't understand is the cases you cite are either of the type Judge Tatel was discussing with you, where there was no other opportunity to challenge, or involved a facial constitutional challenge. And neither of those situations exists here.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe the reasoning of the cases where those issues came up do not, for whatever reason, carve out constitutional challenges or no further appellate route situations as the only exceptions. In fact, the reasoning in National Mining and Free Enterprise—
Well, what could Congress have intended then? And in our Ukiah decision, to point out some of the policy reasons why the argument you're making would just undercut what Congress had in mind in vesting exclusive jurisdiction in this court.
Yes, Your Honor. I think to be clear, we need to talk about what it is that Congress is investing exclusive jurisdiction in this court about. I know that there is, in the FERC briefing, a very loose use of the phrase that Section 19B gives to this court exclusive jurisdiction over, quote-unquote, agency determinations of the FERC. But in fact, that's not what 19B says. And with reference to Ukiah, the section at issue there, Section 21C in the Federal Trade Commission's statute, had a very wide scope. It actually talked about any person that's required by a cease and desist order to perform a variety of actions must petition the Court of Appeals at the end of the process. And that is the clause that the court construed to swallow up the type of challenge in Ukiah. Now, there are obviously other cases where there are, as I mentioned, 19B-type clauses, and the court, after looking at the clause, decides it does not fit within the exact wording of the section. For example, in National Mining, the prescription there was to orders, and the challenge, obviously, was to the regulations. Now, the court's reasoning there wasn't if it's a challenge to the regulations, by definition, it falls outside of a 19B-type clause. It simply looked at the exact language and said, what is being challenged here is not the order, it's the regulation. It falls outside of the scope of this particular clause.
In this case?
No, in National Mining.
Oh. In National Mining.
But here there's an order, and that's what the 19B says. 19B covers orders.
Actually, I believe the 19B covers only situations where we're aggrieved by an order of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
That's what I just said.
And 19B does not cover a situation where the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission certainly determines the extent of its jurisdiction.
Well, it issued a show cause order here.
That was one manifestation of its determination, Judge, but clearly the determination took place independent of the show cause order, as shown by the factual history here as to the pronouncements that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has made. And the court has allowed challenges to agency determinations that were made even in the pronouncements of agency heads, such as in SIPA Gaigi or National Automatic Laundry. And essentially what we have here is
what was the first case?
SIPA Gaigi. And National Automatic Laundry, what we have here is an application in the district court that had two elements, one that challenged the agency determination and one that tried to enjoin, obviously, the current manifestation of that agency determination. And it's important that we not allow the FERC to conflate the two. I believe my time is up. I'll save the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Thank you. We'll hear counsel for intervener.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Bradford Berry for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. The CFTC intervened in this case to address the question of whether FERC's administrative enforcement action intrudes on the CFTC's exclusive jurisdiction as set forth in Section 2A-1A of the Commodity Exchange Act. That provision
Do you have a view on the issue we were just discussing with counsel?
We have not taken a position, Your Honor, on that issue. The most that I could say is that if the court finds that it does have discretion to address the merits here, we think that guidance to the two agencies involved would be helpful.
Section 2. Can I ask you if CFTC, you're an intervener here, could you have filed a separate action, your own declaratory relief action?
In the district court?
In the district court.
Well, I think we would probably run into the same problem that Mr. Kim was just facing, the question being whether what we were complaining about was a FERC order and whether the exclusive remedy for that would fall in the Court of Appeals.
But you wouldn't be a person aggrieved, right? I mean, in other words, it wouldn't be an order issued against you.
That's true.
Or controlling you.
That's
so
true.
Would the court have jurisdiction to hear your separate claim?
Your Honor, that's not a question that we have studied in depth, and I would hate to give an answer that is ill-considered. But, it would turn on what the word aggrieved means within Section 19B. If that means that the order has to be issued against the CFTC, I think you're correct. We would not be covered by that. But if aggrieved means that you are troubled by or have problems with the FERC order, then I think we probably would be.
So in that case, even your agency couldn't resolve this question short of going through some kind of administrative process with FERC?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And it's an interesting issue because what we would have had to do in order to go through the administrative process is intervene in the FERC proceeding. And be allowed to intervene in the FERC proceeding. And then once FERC had issued its order, petition FERC for rehearing of that order before we could argue that jurisdiction would lie in the Court of Appeals. So it would be an awkward process, to say the least. Section 2A-1A of the Commodity Exchange Act provides in express terms that the CFTC shall have exclusive jurisdiction with respect to transactions involving futures contracts traded on a designated contract market. NYMEX is a designated contract market.
I just want to go back to your answer to Judge Brown. That's sort of an interesting proposition, that if an agency is proceeding in an area where a second agency thinks it has exclusive jurisdiction, your position is it would be awkward for the second agency to seek to intervene in the first agency proceeding?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the position it would put us in.
I understand your point, awkward in one sense, but I don't see that there's any bar. You're not arguing there'd be a bar to your doing that, and you don't have to just sit back and let the other agency essentially, carve out what you view as part of your exclusive jurisdiction.
Well, there wouldn't be any bar to us seeking to intervene in the FERC case. But FERC would have to allow us to intervene before we could be heard in that proceeding and set forth our position. So it would be awkward in that sense.
Well, I'm not familiar enough with FERC's rules on intervention, but I'm just thinking of the federal rules.
Do you know of any case where, other than in a situation where Congress has expressly given one federal agency authority over another, such as in the federal labor area, you know, where the federal employee labor, whatever that thing's called, administration, has authority over other agencies. Except for that, do you know of any case where the courts have allowed one federal agency to actually sue another federal agency? I mean, you could certainly file an amicus brief. I mean, suppose this were that FERC had allowed you to intervene in its proceedings in the case we're here under 19D. Would your agency be considered? Go back to the question Judge Brown asked. Any party to a proceeding aggrieved by an order. I know of no case where a federal agency has been allowed to do that. Do you?
I can't cite one, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And we didn't find any in our research.
Right.
I guess all I know is what the Attorney General has some authority to resolve conflicts between agencies. I don't know if this would extend to the administrative agencies. Interesting question, but we'll never get to it.
The point that we wanted to make with regard to the merits is that our statute expressly gives us exclusive jurisdiction over futures trading on designated contract markets. FERC has definitely exercised jurisdiction over futures trading on designated contract markets. They are prosecuting an administrative case in which they assert that the respondents in that case manipulated the settlement price of futures contracts traded on the NYMEX. And they assert that the means of manipulation was futures trading on the NYMEX. Their actions are squarely conflict with the Commodity Exchange Act, and they are not permitted by the Natural Gas Act. There is nothing in the Natural Gas Act that gives FERC any jurisdiction with regard to futures trading on a designated contract market. My time has expired.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Robert Solomon for the FERC. Turning first to the jurisdiction of this Court and turning first to the questions raised by Judges Brown and Rogers, the CFTC did not participate at all in the underlying FERC proceeding. It's not surprising that the CFTC did not participate. It executed a memorandum of understanding with the FERC in October of 2005 as directed by the Congress in Section 23C of the amended Natural Gas Act. And in October 2005, the CFTC agreed with the FERC. This is page 281 of the appendix, that there can be activity affecting both CFTC jurisdictional and FERC jurisdictional markets. Indeed, at page 282.
Well, I don't think that's the question we were talking about.
Well, Your Honor.
You're now talking about the merits of the case, right?
Well, I'm explaining why the CFTC did not participate before the FERC. Your Honor has made reference to Section 19B of the Natural Gas Act, and for judicial review purposes, that statute only pertains to a party which has been aggrieved by an order of the FERC. Yeah. The CFTC could not have sought judicial review as a petitioner because the CFTC was not a party. It wasn't even an intervener in the underlying agency proceeding.
Okay.
What I'm trying to get at is here is an agency who thinks that FERC is intruding on its exclusive domain. They would like that to stop. So my question is, how would they do that?
The CFTC and Mr. Hunter do have options. One option is not, as Mr. Hunter did here, seeking to enjoin the FERC proceeding before the FERC has even issued its order to show cause. Rather, Mr. Hunter or the CFTC can do one of two things, either do what the Amaranth entities and Mr. Donahoe did, which is to petition for review.
I thought you just told us that the agency couldn't do that under 19B.
There are two general approaches. One, if in fact you are a party.
No. Just stick with the commodity, okay. The agency.
I'll stick with the second one, which is seeking extraordinary relief under the All Writs Act.
No. You're missing our questions. You said, we know what Mr. Hunter's option is. If we don't have jurisdiction, he could have waited until the FERC proceedings were finished and filed a petition for review, right?
Yes.
Okay, Judge Brown's question is, how can the Commodity Future Trading Commission raise that same question on the merits, legally? How does it do it?
The CFTC. You,
yeah.
The CFTC.
Whatever it is. The commodity, yeah.
And
you've already told us it can't. Oh, so if FERC allowed it to intervene, it could petition under 19B?
I think so. I am not aware.
Really? Do you know of any case like that where a federal agency has been allowed to do that?
I would have to go back to the 1990s in our hydro licensing cases in which I'm aware of a Department of Interior versus FERC case. But, Your Honor,
that's a case, again, I think those are cases where the Interior Department has a statutory role in the FERC proceedings, correct?
Correct.
Okay. The commission here doesn't. They're just arguing that FERC is intruding on its jurisdiction.
That is correct. And the appropriate position for the CFTC to take if it believes that the FERC is encroaching upon the CFTC's jurisdiction is to intervene as a party before the agency, and if it is not permitted to petition for judicial review, to file an amicus brief or to file as an intervener in support of a true, legitimate petitioner. Going back to the All Writs Act and Mr. Hunter, if Mr. Hunter wishes to halt the FERC proceeding before the FERC has issued a final determination, it does have recourse under the All Writs Act to file an extraordinary petition, but absent such grounds for a petition for writ of prohibition or a petition for writ of mandamus, Mr. Hunter, like any party to any FERC proceeding, has to await a final agency decision. The only harm alleged here at the appellate stage is the harm attendant to defending oneself before the administrative agency in an agency proceeding, which is a harm little different than that before the Supreme Court in the Standard Oil case, and little different than that before this court in the reliable automatic sprinkler case. As that latter case demonstrates, there is no special ultra vires exception to final agency action. Judge Rogers, you are correct. The only limited exceptions to final review in the Court of Appeals are not present here. There is no constitutional challenge. There is no claim that Section 19B of the Natural Gas Act somehow precludes or does not allow effective judicial review because of the specificity of Section 19B. This case is not like the Aid Association for Lutherans case identified by Mr. Hunter. It's not like the Griffith case. It's more like the Standard Oil, the Reliable Automatic, and indeed the Energy Transfer Partners case that was just decided by the Fifth Circuit concerning a contemporaneously issued show cause order.
I want to go back to free enterprise for a moment. That case, as you say, was a case that involved a constitutional claim. But another way of reading that case was simply that the court there concluded that the challenge was collateral to the review scheme that had been provided there. That, in other words, it was something other than an order or a rule of the board that was being challenged. And you could argue that the same thing is happening here.
You could argue that. There is a collateral order exception to general rules of finality and general judicial review in the Federal Court of Appeals, but that only assumes that there cannot be any effective judicial review of the independent issue, the jurisdictional determination, at the end of final agency action. Mr. Hunter concedes that if, in fact, the challenge is to an order, the normal rules of appellate review apply under Section 19B. He is arguing that pre-decisional determinations, however that is defined, a pre-order determination, is somehow collaterally reviewable in the district court, while simultaneously the Court of Appeals reviews orders issued by the agency. That, of course, would lead to more FERC appeals. You would have D.C. Circuit review of district court determinations from non-orders, and of course you would have D.C. Circuit review of orders made in the normal course of agency review after a final decision after rehearing. Turning to the merits of the case, the second issue concerns the jurisdiction of the agency. This is the issue that Mr. Berry was raising. Market manipulation is special. It was identified and singled out by Congress as particularly pernicious behavior after the energy crisis, after the fall of Enron. The agency, my agency, is trying to harmonize and to reconcile its new authority under the Natural Gas Act with the pre-existing CFTC jurisdiction under the CEA. In particular, the agency is exercising its authority under amended sections 4A, capital A, and section 23, and is arguing that if there is manipulative conduct that affects a transaction otherwise within the exclusive jurisdiction of the CFTC, both the FERC and the CFTC have the ability, the overlapping ability, to regulate. The CEA, section 2A1A, referenced by Mr. Berry, refers to transactions, the CFTC's exclusive jurisdictions over transactions. And we agree that the CFTC continues to have that jurisdiction, but my agency is differentiating between the manipulative conduct affecting that transaction and the transaction in the first instance. It is alleged here that Mr. Hunter sold thousands of futures contracts in the last 30 minutes of the trading period. Each of the individual sales are individual transactions that the CFTC has exclusive jurisdiction to regulate. The CFTC also has exclusive jurisdiction over the day-to-day operation of the exchanges, NYMEX, that handle those transactions. But the manipulative conduct here is in the aggregate, whether the experiment entertained by Mr. Hunter of dumping thousands of contracts would have the desired effect of smashing down the settlement price of futures contracts, of giving him a windfall in contrary positions in financial derivatives, options and swaps and other markets, and whether that has an effect on FERC jurisdictional physical markets. It is that type of manipulative conduct, independent and separate from the transaction, that provides the hook for FERC jurisdiction. We're not talking about all conduct affecting CFTC jurisdictional transactions. We're talking about manipulative conduct, because Congress singled out market manipulation as something special for the FERC to investigate. That is what it has done here for the protection of ratepayers and for the protection of the public interest, to make sure that another California energy crisis, that another Enron, does not occur.
All right. Thank you. We have your argument.
Thank you.
I think you were referring to FERC jurisdiction. But
yes.
Of the points we heard, there are two that I want to address in greater detail. First is the issue of whether the challenge mounted by Hunter in the district court falls within Section 19B, or whether it is collateral to Section 19B. I think it is important to remember that Hunter was attempting two things. First, to get a declaratory judgment before an order to show cause was ever issued, where there was not 100% certainty as to exactly when the FERC would do it or what it would do, to have the court adjudicate the dispute that arises under the Declaratory Judgments Act, and second, to enjoin the issuance of the order itself. Now,
I mean, the first one presents you with another jurisdictional problem of ripeness, right? Even if there was jurisdiction in the district court.
Certainly, Judge, I think if we had a situation where the FERC was not declaring in the abstract that it had jurisdiction, it actually had sent a letter to Mr. Hunter saying that it viewed that it had jurisdiction over the particular trading that he did and was going to enforce against him. And that was an agency determination that was already over. It was a decision that was made without any order, and certainly under the standards of the Declaratory Judgments Act would qualify as a sufficient controversy for the district court to take jurisdiction. Based on the position of the FERC, if the FERC is basically saying, if the FERC had never issued an order here, that the FERC's determination would be unreviewable, even though the letter it had sent to Mr. Hunter created an actual controversy that was affecting his business. And second, the FERC's position is, even if it makes a determination without any order, such that it's not even arguable that it fits within Section 19B, that somehow by issuing an order, it now divests the judiciary of any jurisdiction and it aggregates all the jurisdiction to itself. And that's simply not what Section 19B says.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.